The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show
on Relevant Radio.
President Biden is working to relieve some of the pain at the pump. Now he's considering a gas tax federal holiday that could save almost 19 cents a gallon. Biden says he'll make a decision by the end of the week. The president is also considering sending gas rebate cards, but it's unclear if either option has the political support necessary to pass Congress.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Yeah, that was an idea that President Biden floated, a federal gas tax holiday. I guess if you fill up your car, you're probably like, yeah, give it to me. It is getting expensive out there. Congress will temporarily suspend the federal gas tax. Will it have enough support? I don't know. I do not know. I think these are Band-Aids for a much bigger problem. And I think we need some sutures right now, don't we? We need to stop the bleeding. And we need to look at the big picture, not just put something on top of it. Good afternoon. First of all, it's good to be here with you today. I'm delighted to be back. We've got a really mixed bag today. I hope you can hang out all 3 hours. I'll be here for you. And if you miss anything, I just want to remind you, you can go to our archives. My producer, Maggie, is on top of it. She'll have that up for you about an hour after we're off the air, maybe sooner. But just check back. And we've had some great conversations throughout the week. You can check into those as well. But gas, just one more thing on this gas issue, and then we'll move on. I don't know what you're paying in your area. It turns out that gas prices are staying, in the $5 a gallon area. And when gas is high like that, it doesn't make for a very popular president, right? It doesn't. President Biden's numbers are sinking. Gas price inflations continue to go up. So the president floated an idea that his own, when he was vice president, President Obama thought was a gimmick. He totally downplayed it. But look, if you don't have answers, if you don't have solutions, you're going to try to come up with something. I got to give him credit for that. At least they're trying something, right? A federal tax holiday for the next 3 months. The federal gas tax, if you don't know how it works, you might look at your gas bill and say, well, why is it so much in this state and not as much in that state? And how come everybody seems to have the same price? And well, federal gas tax across the nation, 18.4 cents, 18 and a half cents, basically a gallon, right? So you take that off the price that you're now paying, the average, let's just say $5 a gallon for easy math, right? And you're left with about $4.82 a gallon, which is still well above the average of around $2.80 when the president took office, right? Just think about how the price of gasoline has doubled, how much more you are paying on a weekly basis. On top of that, he gave a speech today, and the president asked the states to put their taxes on a holiday as well. So those taxes, if you get the federal tax break, and then let's say you get your state tax break, those taxes range anywhere from 9 cents a gallon, that's Alaska, right? All the way up to 58 cents a gallon in the state of Pennsylvania. I was just there. PA paying a lot of state tax. I was shocked when I saw those numbers. I didn't expect Pennsylvania's taxes to be that high on tax, the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. But those taxes, of course, are used for building, they're for maintaining roads. So if you ask the state, hey, look, can you give that back to everybody, as well as federal level too, there's going to be a loss of revenue and nothing's free. You can give money away until you run out of it, right? Until you run out of other people's money. It works until there's no more and you're going to lose that revenue. It could impact the roads that you're driving. We already know that the infrastructure of this country is in desperate need of an overhaul. Our bridges, our dams, our highways, we've talked about this many, many times. So we'll see how Congress responds to the request. I don't know. I don't know how it'll shake out, and we'll see what happens. Again, everybody likes free money. I saw that during, that $2.1 trillion spending that we saw not too long ago. But you also see what happens when we spend too much money, when there's few goods, too much money chasing too few goods. We have inflation, and inflation's now, about 8.5%? So, and could possibly continue to be on the climb. There's another story. I don't know who's going to run for president against Joe Biden. I don't know whether Donald Trump will get in with all that's going on right now. And there's January 6th hearings. Will they impact his potential run? Would Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, who a lot of people think, hey, we'd love to see him run. Some people like his conservative family values. Governor DeSantis is expected to sign a bill that would make it illegal for any future governor to shut down religious practice in a future state of emergency. Now, how can you not love that, huh? I mean, I just want to say bravo to you, Governor DeSantis. Thank you very much, sir. You know, when the pandemic shut down, you know, it impacted, when the pandemic took place, I should say, it shut down everything, right? And we saw what happened from, you know, restaurants to churches. You couldn't go. You couldn't go to mass on Sunday. A lot of states like California, New York, they didn't allow you to go to church. You couldn't go. And that, of course, it violated the very first liberty enumerated in our Bill of Rights. The right for you to practice your faith. They didn't care, right? But again, we're looking at two very liberal states. The Florida bill will make sure that that can't happen. It won't happen, at least it can't happen in the Sunshine State. You know, if another state of emergency is declared, you'll be able to practice your faith. So if you're into, you know, if you were frustrated by what went down, that might be good news for you. And we'll see if other states follow suit as well. Boy, there was some news I didn't get to yesterday, and something I want you to look forward to as well. There is a rare astronomical event that is going to be taking place. I just thought I'd put it on your radar. You can get, you know, maybe out of bed really early in the morning and check out the pre-dawn sky for the rest of the month. Here's just a little breakdown of what's happening. Check it out.
It's an interesting show going on, and it's really kicked off over the last couple of nights and will continue through the end of the month. All five of the major planets you can see in the early morning pre-dawn sky right now. Now, the hiccup for that is I said pre-dawn. Dawn right now, or sunrise right now, 5:37-ish. To be able to see these planets, you're going to need to be up really before about 5 o'clock in the morning before we start to lose the planet Mercury in the early morning daylight there, breaking of dawn. But it is an amazing sight in the sky. The moon's even getting into the picture here. And we are going to see this for the next couple weeks. Eventually, even the moon will move in between Venus and Mars and sort of go into the place of where Earth is in the lineup there. So my very excellent mother just served us. You know, you take it from there. This is it's just a really cool thing. So again, won't happen again until 2040. So you may want to get up early and check it out. If you're already up early, maybe you work an overnight shift. It's a great thing to check out.
I love those astronomical events. However, I just can't get out of bed. I can't do it as much as I'd love to. One night, there was, I think, the Perseid, I guess, meteor shower. This is several years ago. And I remember waking up our kids, my wife and I, woke them up in the middle of the night. And we threw blankets out on the lawn and we went out. Where we lived was kind of dark. And man, the sky lit up in the middle of the night. And that was kind of cool to go ahead and see that. But I think it's cool that Mercury, Venus, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn are all going to be lining up on the eastern horizon. Something that happened, I guess, 18 years ago. And as you heard in that report there, there will be on Fridays. So you have to get up late, I guess, after you go to bed on Thursday, get up really early. And there'll be a crescent moon in between Mercury and Venus. And the best time to check it out, half hour before sunrise. So, but if you live closer to the Arctic Circle, you know, I guess you're going to miss this one. One final thing, just speaking of the skies, NASA. And, you know, there was an event that happened back in the 1800s, 1860 something. It was called the Carrington Event. It was a big solar flare, knocked out all the telegraphs, communications ceased. If we were ever to have a solar flare of that intensity again, anybody who has got computers or computers in their cars or if they're not insulated and protected, you know, we could be brought to our knees. NASA was reporting, and they're saying, hey, don't panic. But apparently sunspots, sun activity is growing rapidly. Sunspots are cooler spots, and they're caused by increased magnetic activity. And they can generate what they call solar flares. It's an outburst of energy that, you know, if it's large enough, it could disrupt electronic communications. And NASA saying to people that, look, this sunspot isn't anything unusual. You know, we're not saying to panic. Just want to make you aware of it. You might see the northern lights because that's what often happens, too, with that solar activity, if that happens. But, you know, I was thinking about this just as a side note. With all that's going on in the world today, right, what better way to humble man? What better way to bring us to our knees? Could you imagine? Not that I won't ever see this, because I'm very dependent too. I would be totally shocked if something like that happened. It would grind, you know, our culture to a halt. If we lost our electronics and something like that ever took place. I'm not saying it's going to. Hey, finally, one other thing. I want to talk to you about what's happening with pregnancy centers around the country. There are 21 Democrats that have asked Google to censor results about crisis pregnancy centers. I'll have to fill you in on that story. But that comes as these centers are now coming under even greater attack, literal attack, by a lot of pro-abortion supporters, right? In fact, you could call these pro-abortionists, and I call them this, domestic terrorists, right? That term is thrown around pretty lightly with parents who don't want their kids indoctrinated, right? And they go to school board meetings and they voice their concern. They're called domestic terrorists. And yet these people who are throwing Molotov cocktails, who are threatening greater terror, have not been dubbed domestic terrorists. I don't know why. They certainly are causing terror. Two more pro-life centers were vandalized over the weekend. Both of them were in the state of Michigan. The Lennon Pregnancy Center in Dearborn Heights, actually had its windows and doors smashed in and graffiti was spray painted on it. And the pregnancy center in the suburb of Detroit, the Detroit suburb of Redford, had the same thing happen. So we'll see how much the state of Michigan bothers to investigate these incidences. If this was, as I said, a Jewish synagogue, if this was a Planned Parenthood, that's a better example. Imagine if this happened to Planned Parenthood centers. Can you imagine the investigation, the outcry, the coverage by the mainstream media? You know, in New York, it's not just these domestic terrorists that pro-life centers have to deal with. The governor there, and we need to pray for Kathleen Hochul. My gosh, this woman is another one that makes my blood boil. She recently signed a bill into law that sets up a state commission to investigate, and I use that term very loosely, to investigate pro-life pregnancy centers around the state. And according to James Harden, he's the CEO of Compass Care in Buffalo, the pregnancy center that was firebombed, remember that story? Well, the law requires those pregnancy centers to turn over information on donors and confidential patients, you know, confidential patient records. All of the records, all those internal memos, all those files and policies are going to be inspected by government authorities. And after that will come the regulations, and those regulations will be designed, ultimately, I believe, to put them out of business. I've invited Dr. Bill Donahue to stop by today. He's president and CEO of the Catholic League for Religious and Civil Rights. He's been on top of this story, and it's always good to tap into his genius and expertise. Dr. Donahue, welcome back.
How you doing, Drew? You're doing great work, buddy.
Thank you, sir. That means a lot coming from you. You've been on the front lines for a long time, defending our liberties and our faith. And boy, the battle for life is really coming to a climax here, a pinnacle. I know you. I know New York legislature. Legislature there passed a bill on this. The governor signed it. But fill me in on what's going on here. I mean, is it legal to turn over patients, you know, medical records and a lot of this other information? It sounds like Nazi Germany or one of those communist countries, something that they would do to try to get more info on their people.
Well, that's going to be contested in the courts, and we've won some and lost some over the years. I do think that after we win on Roe v. Wade, it's a foregone conclusion. It'll either come down tomorrow or next week, Monday or Wednesday probably. That brings us to the next stage, and the next stage will be a war on the crisis pregnancy centers conducted by people like Hochul, Gavin Newsom in California, and others. That's what they're going to try to do, because they ultimately don't believe that a woman should have a right to choose. That's really at the heart of this. They believe that abortion is a good. It's a good for society. Some of these people, of course, are racist, like Margaret Sanger. She said she called black people weeds. They were weeds that had to be gotten rid of, and the best way to do that was be through birth control, not abortion, in fairness to her, but then Planned Parenthood, which she founded, evolved into abortion as the ultimate form of eugenics. So I do think that the war is on. We know that that you mentioned correctly that in Buffalo, Amherst, just outside of Buffalo, firebombing in New York, that's her hometown, Kathy Hochul's hometown. She didn't say a word about that. She's provided no money to Jim Harden, yet she's appropriated $10 million. She signed a bill giving $10 million to abortion clinics, which have not been bombed. But there's no money for the facilities which have been bombed. I mean, if anybody has any doubt as to what the agenda is on the part of the hardcore Democrat left, this should remove that doubt altogether.
You know, doctor, I've thought, let's just take the word, you know, pro-life center, crisis pregnancy center out. Let's replace it with Planned Parenthood. What do you think the reaction would be by mainstream media? Because there's really been very little coverage of this in many outlets. Not all. There have been people who have been covering, but very, very little in some of the more left-leaning. And if you replace that word Planned Parenthood, you know, what do you think would happen? Not just for the media, but just in terms of the government's responses. You know, Nancy Pelosi, Joe Biden, the Attorney General. What would the response be, in your opinion?
Well, number one, the January 6th nonsense would be kicked off the front page. This would be the front page story. There would be demands to bring Merrick Garland back from Ukraine because he has to deal with this issue. There'd be calls for to have armed guards and maybe the National Guard be brought in. That all the drama that we've seen laid out because of the riots of BLM and Antifa and everybody else, all that drama would be back. They're only interested in violence when it goes in one direction. They should be opposed to violence against innocent people, regardless of what the issue is or who they're targeting. But we've seen now consistently on the part of the left, and unfortunately a lot of people in the Democratic Party, that violence, interest in violence, is only goes one way. Yep. And so, yeah, there's no question about it. It would not be ignored. It'd be the front page news.
Do you think the authorities are really working on investigating that firebombing in Buffalo? There's cause for suspicion simply because the governor is just so hostile to the pro-life movement, and we haven't heard a whole lot. What do you think is happening on the back end of that?
Well, we know that it took them a long time before they even began. Now that they've indicated that there is something going on, there probably is something. How intense the probe is, I can only guess. But I'm sure they're covering themselves by saying, well, there is an investigation. Investigation has commenced. I doubt very seriously that they're stepping on the gas.
Your take on what's going to happen? I think the Supreme Court is going to drop this thing either, like you said, Friday or possibly Monday or Wednesday. Their very last day is when they're going to drop it. And how persistent, how long, how violent do you think we're going to see, you know, that night of rage or that day of rage or that week of rage? Do you think it's going to be persistent? It'll be one and done. Do you think authorities are going to be ready for it? Where do you think it's going to happen? Are they going to burn just pro-life cities and states that you know, have not enshrined abortion, like New York and other places? I mean, where
it
will
go on
this
for at least a week. I don't know that it'll go on for the rest of the summer. It doesn't grip these people the way some other things do. I can tell the listeners this. It's out. I mean, a couple of months ago, I asked for a meeting with Cardinal Dolan, and the meeting was about my anticipation of this. I saw this coming. And I said, you better have the cops guard St. Patrick's Cathedral, you. Oh, yeah. I know I'm on a list of that the NYPD look at in terms of Catholic leaders, and why, because it's coming. Now, I didn't anticipate when I spoke to Cardinal Dolan that there would be the leak of the draft. I didn't know that. I never anticipated, obviously. That changed things very quickly. In other words, the violence started in sooner than I thought it would be. I think that the Democrats have to be very careful on this, because if they're seen as already being seen as being weak on crime, and violence is one of the top issues, and New York is the number one issue, it goes beyond inflation, because where I live is just incredible. I'm right here across the street from Penn Station, which is the worst part of all of New York City, is right here where I'm at in Penn Station, and up the block is Times Square. The two most dangerous areas in New York City is where I operate from, and where I'm speaking to you from right now. And so there's going to be problems there. They're going to target Catholic churches, and they're going to go after crisis pregnancy centers. How long it will last will depend on the willingness of the authorities to crack down. I don't think that Mayor Adams here, a former cop, wants to let it get out of control. I think the results are going to be very spotty. In places like Portland and Seattle, where you have a culture of lawlessness, where they don't believe in accountability, that could go on all summer long, you know, like the Summer of Love that we had 2 years ago when they burnt the place down.
You know, Doctor, I know I have a few moments left here. I'm just curious. We have midterms coming up. In terms of the electorate, how big of a role does this play? I don't know if it does in light of the economy and things along those lines. I mean, when your ex-governor, Cuomo, when he had to step down when he left, I thought, well, thank God. Maybe we'll get somebody more pro-life. Hochul takes over. And as you point out, or as I read somewhere, she is called pro-lifers Neanderthals. I marvel at how these officials get elected while you're just alienating at least half of their constituency. How big is this issue in the upcoming midterms in general with the people? Does it sway them at all, or does the economy and these other things outweigh it?
There's no question it doesn't sway them the way the inflation does, the crashing of our border, foreign policy disasters, and crime that is out of control and is scaring people in New York City to go to go right. Listen, what happened when I was a kid in Long Island, yep. It was Republican. Then it became Democrat. No Republican could win. Last November, Long Island went sweepingly red. Nobody who was a Democrat could win any place. Now, she's from Buffalo. That's generally more Republican area, too. Mm-hmm. It's going to be interesting how it plays out, but unfortunately, New York City is still in the grip of the of liberalism, though with Mayor Adams here, things are beginning to change. Here's what's going to happen, I think, in November.
Sure.
But the people on our side who are concerned about violence and are concerned about inflation and how Biden has essentially dismantled our society in the matter of no time, they will come out in record numbers. The Democrats will not. We're already seeing evidence. They are totally dispirited. They don't like what they see from the Republicans, that's for sure. But they also are not enamored by what they see the Democrats are doing. They can't even defend Biden. Only 69% of Democrats think he's doing okay. Biden's at a 32% record low favorability rating. People are walking away from him. So what will happen is, will the Democrats come out and all? No, the Democrats will be dispirited. That means they'll sit at home, and you'll see record numbers of people, independents, not just Republicans. There aren't enough Republicans to pull this off. Independents and Republicans will come out in droves. Right. It's going to be a whipping in November,
but
you know, we're still going to have our hands full.
Well, Doctor, thank you for making time for us. I always appreciate your analysis, your commentary, and insight. If people want more info, they want to get connected to you, what's the best way to do that?
Go right to our website at CatholicLeague.org. One word, www.CatholicLeague.org.
And before I let you go, I know you came out with a new book recently. How's that going? We really should get you on to talk about that at some point.
Oh, yes, The Truth About Clergy Sexual Abuse. It's done very well with a lot of very important people. I am struck by the response from the Catholic and the secular left.
Really?
They don't know what to do with it. It's got 840-plus footnotes in it to back up everything I say. They have ignored it. They have not attacked me because they're going to attack me, then I'm going to attack back. And I've got the evidence, and they don't. They have feelings. I have evidence. They don't deal in feelings. I'm a social scientist. They've tried to ignore it. Now, that's one of the ways in which I thought they might respond, because they're at the end of the day, they're cowards, and they know they're wrong.
Let's get you on. I'd love to talk about it. I think it's a worthy discussion, and one that has, again, the media has really distorted a lot of the facts. So thanks for what you do. We'll catch
up
soon.
Thank you so
much.
Thank you for what you do.
That's Dr. Bill Donahue. Check him out, CatholicLeague.org. I need to take a short pause when I return. And we'll take a look at a victory for religious freedom. This is some good news. Stay with me.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio. Connect with Drew on the Relevant Radio app.
Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forester.
Well, a big win for school choice and religious freedom. The Supreme Court has ruled that parents can use state funds to send their children to religious schools.
The decision is expected to have an impact on tuition programs nationwide.
The case challenged a Maine law prohibiting parents from using state aid to send their children to faith-based schools. The state offered tuition payments for students to attend private schools in areas where public schools are not available, but faith-based schools did not qualify. The justices called that discrimination. In their 6-3 ruling, the justices said Maine could not exclude religious schools from the program. Chief Justice John Roberts writing in the majority opinion, a neutral benefit program that gives public funds to religious organizations through the independent choices of the recipients does not violate the Constitution's Establishment Clause. And Maine's non-sectarian requirement violates the Free Exercise Clause of the First Amendment because the program operates to identify and exclude otherwise eligible schools on the basis of their religious exercise.
This is the Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Yeah, that report coming from CBN. And yesterday you heard the Supreme Court ruled 6-3 in favor of parents against the state of Maine. They sued, you heard in the report, because the state refused to fund their children going to a religious school in a rural area where there is no public high school, right? The state did fund students going to private schools, though. And as I shared with you yesterday, this law goes all the way back to 1874. They've been doing that because if you've ever been to Maine, it is a gorgeous state. There's still vast parts of it that are incredibly rural. They didn't want to have to pay for building public high schools in certain areas or transporting kids to school. So they just paid the tuition costs for the private or religious schools. Made sense, right? So fast forward, you know, almost 100 years, 100 plus. In 1981, the state's attorney general decides to drop the funding for religious schools because he was afraid of violating the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment. And a few years ago, some parents said, wait a minute, this isn't right. So they sued. And as you heard in the report, the Supreme Court ruled in favor of the parents. So this decision has people in favor of church and state separation, including three dissenting judges in a tizzy. And I want to talk about that. We'll talk about separation of church and state today. And you know, what are the origins of it? We know it was Thomas Jefferson's letter to the Danbury Baptist, right? Is this really a case of separation of church and state? Some people are worried that the supposed barrier between the church and state is now being lowered by this decision, rather than seeing, well, and other people, they're rejoicing in it, really. I mean, Chief Justice Roberts, he wrote that if the state was going to fund students, you know, going to these private schools, then they also had to do the same thing to religious schools. It makes sense, right? Maine has the option. You could build schools where there are none. Go ahead and spend the money. Go ahead and transport the kids. They're not doing that. So a lot going on here. Let's talk about it with Dr. Daniel Mark. He is a professor of political science at Villanova University in Pennsylvania. He's also the past chairman of the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom. It's great to have him back with us today. Right now, I think he is senior fellow of the Religious Freedom Institute's Northern American Action Team. Danielle, good to have you back. It's good to talk with you once again. Thanks for being here.
Hey, great to be here. Thank you.
So I would love your take on this. Why are the dissenting, why are those who are dissenters, why are they so concerned about yesterday's decision? I mean, to me, this hearing of Justice Roberts, it seemed to be a basic matter of fairness and equity. Can you elaborate on that?
Sure. Well, we've had, and I agree with, you know, all the analysis you said up front, we've had a few decades now, though, of what I would see as an overly restrictive interpretation of the First Amendment, the idea that we have to keep government and religion as far away as possible. And, you know, this we've seen, remember, not very long ago, there was a case about a giant cross that was up, and, you know, was that, you know, a historical thing, and was that too much? And so all kinds of different ways in which people worry about government and religion being too intertwined, and it's not the case, really, historically, that these kinds of things are constitutional problems. I mean, you mentioned in your intro, right, that that this was a relatively new thing that was instituted in Maine, and so you've got people who are worried about that, and for some of them, I suppose it's a legitimate worry. I mean, we do have an Establishment Clause in the Constitution, right? We do have we do have a First Amendment that tells us that government should not, depends how you want to take it, but government should not be establishing religion. But that's not what this is, and they're worried. I think obviously more broadly, this is connected to political interests and political concerns about school choice, really. I mean, right, what this opens up the door for vouchers in a huge, huge way. This doesn't immediately open the floodgates because the state actually has to have such a program, and then that program has to be neutral. It's only once they have the program that it has to be neutral and it has to include religious schools.
Right.
But obviously, this makes it constitutional to have vouchers go to religious schools in a way that it wasn't before, and that is a potentially political earthquake that goes, you know, far beyond the small number of schools in Maine that are really being addressed here.
So how will that ripple out? What do you see coming as a result of it?
I mean, the possibility is, you know, and there's a pretty robust school choice movement in America, which I think is good. And it got a lot stronger during the pandemic with all the closures, you know, especially in a lot of cases with public schools being closed and private schools being opened. But of course, it's hamstrung by the fact that for a long time and in a lot of places, it's been very difficult to get public money going to private schools, or just, you know, the idea of school vouchers that instead of funding public schools directly, the parents are just entitled to a certain amount of money to take with their child to whatever school that they choose, which seems like a pretty good idea on a lot of levels. And this might really, but there have been constitutional barriers because there have been objections over time that would be a violation of the Establishment Clause. So if I'm going to send my kid to a Muslim school and I'm going to do that in part by paying tuition through a government voucher, like everybody else in the state who'd be
right.
taking a voucher to the school of their choice, that might run afoul of the Establishment Clause of the Constitution. But now that we have the court saying pretty clearly that that's not the case, and, you know, taking it even further than they did not that long ago in previous decisions, that might really energize the movement, because now before you might say, well, you know, we can try to get the political momentum going for this, but we're still going to run up against the Constitution and kind of like have our crash
mm-hmm.
landing,
right.
you know, on the First Amendment. But now that's not the case. So hopefully it puts a lot of energy into the school choice movement, and hopefully we see more and more states passing voucher programs or other versions. You know, lots of different ways to do this, I suppose.
Well, let's do this. Let's take a few calls. If you want to join us, 888-914-9149. Mark is listening in Houston, Texas. He has a comment for you, Professor. Mark, you're on the air with Dr. Danielle Mark. Good afternoon.
Well, I'm just so pleased that they had this really in favor of, you know, private schools and stuff. I'm from a family of eight, and my parents put all eight of us through 8 years of Catholic school. It was a superior education to public schools. My poor parents paid taxes their whole life, and they paid tuition on top of that, and that was not right. And I'm glad it's finally turning a corner.
Well, thanks for your call, Mark. Professor, I'll let you respond.
Yeah, I'm in the exact same situation currently, and I couldn't agree with, you know, I live in a very, very wealthy public school district where their taxes are, our property taxes, even on my tiny little plot, are sky high. So
mm-hmm.
I'm paying a ton of that, and then separately trying to put my kids in a religious school, you know, so
right.
paying the tuition on top of that. And so I know the burden firsthand, and I agree, and I hope that, you know, it's not going to help me right now in my state today,
right.
but I hope that down the road this means that there's progress on that issue.
You know, when my kids were going to you know, high school and stuff, we sent them to a Catholic school as well. And tuition can get up there. And, you know, you're paying your tax
oh, yeah.
for the public schools. Same time, I'm paying tuition twice almost, you know, or at least my taxes are going to help offset that. But, yeah, I just accept it as the way it was always going to be. You make a decision, you make that sacrifice. But it'll be nice to see some relief for some parents out there. So I think that's part of the problem. Right now, I mean, Catholic education, the cost of it, private education can be very prohibitive. I want to get to another issue, too. We'll take a few calls. There's several people want to join us. But before I go back to the phones, I want to get back to the separation of church and state issue. You know, and again, maybe you can expand on this, explain the origins of this. The decision, does it do anything at all to erode Thomas Jefferson's so-called wall of separation between church and state? And some of the justices were concerned, but... you know, I'd love your take on that. I don't see that.
Well, in a way, indirectly it does, because, again, right, as you said, it's in Jefferson's letter. It's not a phrase that's in the Constitution. It's a right. phrase that appeared in our law in the first time in the 1950s in a school busing case, and I think it was Everson. And so that was, it was, you know, 150 years after Jefferson says this, give or take, that the court for the first time is going to grab this phrase and then use it as the metaphor that's going to control the way we think about this issue. But it's just that it's a metaphor and it doesn't give us any specific boundaries. And so a decision mm-hmm. like this doesn't completely get rid of that. But what it says is what we were calling separation of church and state, the wall of separation was yesterday is not what the wall of separation right. is today. That wall is lower than you think. And the thing to keep an eye out for is the other religious freedom case, the praying coach case, as it's sometimes called, Kennedy versus Bremerton, and that's a case in which it is possible that the justices will more explicitly throw out the Lemon test, which is from this case Lemon v. Kurtzman, where the court took kind of its strictest interpretation and categorized all kinds of things as an improper entanglement of church and state. And if that goes, it might give some more breathing room for there to be contact between church and state that isn't nefarious anyway, but right. that for some number of decades now has been seen as unconstitutional.
So where is that coach? I mean, and maybe you fill us in on the details. He was the coach who would go out and after the game just kneel down and pray, and some team members would join him. Other team members from the opposing team would do the same thing, and he got in a lot of trouble for doing that. What's the status with his case, if that's the one I'm thinking of?
Right. Yeah. So there's one of the things that the justices mentioned back when they were having oral arguments is that there are so many complicated facts in this case, and it's not even clear that everybody normally by the time they get to the Supreme Court, everybody mm-hmm. agrees on the facts and they're arguing about the law. Here, it's not even clear they all agree about the facts. But I think the short version is that the coach would take after the game, the coach took a knee at the 50-yard line mm-hmm. To pray, and again, depending on who you ask, he wasn't doing it to gather anybody around him. He wasn't doing it to make himself the center of attention. And again, right. there's differing views on all that situation. So we'll have to see what the court says. But I mean, we may get a decision any day now. And right. while it is primarily a case about free exercise of religion, which meaning the coach's freedom to just practice his religion, we probably will see something that touches on the establishment clause side of things, that the government can't establish religion because the problem is that he's an employee of a public school, and therefore how much is he kind of carrying the weight of government with him as he goes about his actions.
Got it. Let's take another call or two. John in Chicago, thanks for joining us. You're on the air with Professor Mark.
Thank you, Drew and Mark. The thought that occurred to me when we hear these things is a separation of church and state. Our whole country was founded from the Mayflower Compact down through its history in the formation of the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution on a belief in a creator. Our rights come from a creator, not from the government. Right. And so it refers directly that there's something far superior to us. And even in the Netanyahu referred to it when he addressed Congress, he saw on the back wall was the image of Moses. He said, you got these laws of yours from the Ten Commandments. Every law that we have in this country is directly or indirectly based on fairness of the Ten Commandments. And I know myself one time, I live in Chicago in Cook County, a bunch of us went to the Cook County jail to pray with people that were incarcerated. And when I was coming home one night up to Dan Ryan, the thought that occurred to me was that most people that are in the jail were there because they broke one of the Ten Commandments directly or indirectly. Mm-hmm. So if we remove God from our society, his revealed truth, his natural law, and his moral law, we will have total chaos. So how does Satan enter the world? Through ideas. He brought this in that there should be, it went from a separation. The Danbury, Connecticut Baptists were afraid that a religion would be imposed upon them and take.
John, I don't hear you. I think you might have lost his signal. All right, Maggie, check on him. I'll let him finish his thought. But doctor, let's pick up on that. You heard a lot of what he had to say, a lot of great points.
Yeah, I mean, so he brings up, of course, a much, much bigger issue there about the need for God and faith in our society. And, you know, absolutely, at the beginning of his comment, and on the more narrow legal point, I mean, that's exactly right. The contemporary jurisprudence, well, the things that the courts have said over the past few decades are actually much more different from our history than our history is, you know, from the Constitution and from the founding, which is just to say that we've in recent years and in recent decades adopted all kinds of understandings that are not really consistent with the way our country was founded and right. and with the Constitution itself. I mean, there were all, you know, there were presidential proclamations that were religious right. and there right. were, you know, days of prayer and fasting and Thanksgiving and all this stuff that, I mean, all kinds of things. Now, there wasn't a public school system, so they didn't run into these and all these kinds of issues, but it's clear that the separation of church and state was a lot less at the time that, you know, these documents were adopted, ratified.
That's a good point. I never really thought about that. We have oaths of office, right? They conclude with, so help me God. We've got prayers for Congress and state legislatures. We've got days of prayer and fasting. I think Lincoln called for a day of humiliation, prayer and fasting for all the nation in 1861. So it goes on and on. Hey, Professor, thank you for your time. Always good to talk with you. I appreciate it. I'd love your take before I wrap it up here on Dobbs. You think that's coming down Friday? Do you think it's coming down next week? How do you think it will come down? And what do you see when that finally is released?
Well, I don't know what day. I've got friends who think it's coming tomorrow. I've got friends who think it's coming next week. And it's such a crazy guessing game. It's hard to say. But as far as the result, I think it's going to be the same result that we saw in the leak draft. I think that hard to imagine that there are any significant changes. Of course, there'll be dissents attached to it and so on. And, you know, maybe there's possibly a concurrence in the result by Chief Justice Roberts. And so, you know, there'll be a lot more material there. But you can count me as surprised if it's not the result that we heard about with the leaked draft.
And riots to follow or not so much?
I don't know if it's my hope or my expectation, but I think probably a march in D.C. and that sort of thing. But I don't think we're going to see, you know, cities burn the way we saw, summer. So
I share your view on that
kind of thing.
I don't think it's going to be anywhere near the intensity of Black Lives Matters and the death of George Floyd. I mean, people took the streets, they burned all sorts of cities. So we'll see. Hey, yeah. Professor, thank you. Enjoy the rest of your week. Okay. And I hope to catch up with you again soon.
You bet. You too.
All right. Have a great
good
week.
To talk. Bye.
That's Professor Danielle Mark. You can check him out. Great professor of political science, Villanova in Pennsylvania. And when we come back, speaking of religious freedom, I'll share with you the story of two men who lost their heads for religious freedom. We'll talk martyrdom and a whole lot more. Stay with me.
This hour is sponsored by Ave Maria Mutual Funds, where financial goals are aligned with pro-life values and fund decisions are based on investment fundamentals designed to preserve and grow wealth without violating moral beliefs. More information at AveMariaFunds.com.
Pray, hope, and don't worry. This is the Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio. The Chaplet of Divine Mercy, coming up next.
And pray, hope, and don't worry. The famous words from another great saint, St. Padre Pio, right? The great stigmatic, bore the wounds of Christ. Good afternoon. It's good to be with you. In about 10 minutes or so, we'll pray the chaplet. Feel free to dial in at 888-914-9149. We'd love to take your calls as we pray together every afternoon at this time. It's a powerhouse time of prayer. Lots of great things happening. Let's call upon today the intercession of, well, two great men, St. Thomas More and St. John Fisher. And believe we need these guys. We need them more than ever. We need them more than ever. Remember the fortnights that take place every year? The USCCB had these things that often started with this particular feast day. And I just want to speak to you very briefly about them because, yeah, you and I may not be called to lose our head, but there's lots of ways that we can offer and suffer and sacrifice for the truth. These guys were great examples of Christian life. You know, Henry VIII wasn't like that. Unfortunately, he was a man who gave into a lot of vice. You know, he appointed Thomas to be his chancellor. Then he had John Fisher give him counsel. And Henry had a problem with his ego. He had a problem with, you know, overeating. He had a problem with lust. You know, he wanted a male heir to the throne, and his wife, Catherine of Aragon, wasn't able to give him one. She ended up in a convent, and he wanted a divorce. You know, Henry wanted to divorce her, something that the Pope was unwilling to do. He had already given a dispensation to Henry because he had married his brother's widow, and now he's being asked to dispense of the dispensation in order to grant another dispensation for Henry to marry another woman, right? So the answer was no. So what happens? Well, these two saints took different approaches to the issue. John Fisher, who was a bishop, he spoke out against it. He didn't fear Henry's wrath. He knew it was going to come. I mean, this guy was, you know, absolute power corrupts absolutely. But he spoke the truth in the face of all that power, knowing there would be consequences. So what happened? Fisher was ultimately imprisoned three times for it. Pope Paul III, I think it was, made him a cardinal, hoping that that would do something to alleviate his suffering, but it really irritated Henry. In fact, it infuriated him all the more. Thomas More, he had to consider things because he had a family to think about, right? I mean, imagine being a parent and knowing that if you go to jail, if you possibly even lose your life, what's going to happen to your estate? What's going to happen to your family, your wife, your children? Thomas decided not to say anything about the marriage at all. He was just quiet. Henry knew where Thomas was. He knew that Thomas was a good Catholic, that he didn't want it. But eventually, More resigned, the post of chancellor after 3 years in office. Henry still wanted him. I mean, Thomas More resigned, but he still wanted his approval. So Parliament acted, and they named Henry the head of the Church of England. And that act was, when it was passed, demanded that certain people had to sign their names agreeing to the claim. And so they brought it before John Fisher and Thomas More. And this was it. Thomas More would have been glad to be quiet, but they had to refuse. Because they were then put on these sham trials. Both were sentenced to death. John was sentenced at first to be hung, then drawn, and then quartered. They hang you till you almost die. Then they stretch your arms. They practically they quarter you. They rip you apart. They eviscerate you. He was that torture was commuted just to beheading. And then Thomas, he was supposed to be hung to death. That too was changed to beheading. Both these men lost their lives. But there's a lot to learn, right? They gave up their lives because they would not yield on this issue today that confronts us, right? The issue of marriage. They spoke truth even when it was unpopular, even when it meant personal loss. They knew marriage was indissoluble. No one, not even the Pope, can declare a valid marriage invalid. He just can't do it. So they lost their lives for the integrity of the church. And no one can take the place of St. Peter's successor in Rome as the head of the church in any land. Not Thomas, not anybody who, not any court. They can't say that's the case. And these were men. These two men were men of the highest integrity. They were men of learning. And they knew that one day they would face God. And they wanted their conscience intact. And this is really about conscience. Thomas did it under pressure of being a married man and a politician. John did it under pressure of being a priest and a bishop. And it all goes to show that really nothing is impossible with God. They lost their lives. They laid down their lives for this truth. You know, and martyrdom's a powerful gift. Grace comes from it. You know, to the martyr in eternity, I think they shine with a special brilliance. I really do. I think there's something very beautiful about those who lay down their life for Christ. And while you and I make this journey called life, we may not lose our heads. We may not be asked to go to prison or to lose everything we have, especially our life. But we can all suffer little martyrdoms. And as life is hanging in the balance today, this issue of life, when we've got gender and we're redefining it, when our kids are under attack, when marriage has been redefined, when religious freedom's being eroded, I would really ask you to offer up some of your suffering, to offer up those little martyrdoms that come your way. Those little martyrdoms, it might be the way you handle other people. That person really irritates you, right? At work or at home or wherever it might be, in your prayer group or church. There are little martyrdoms, like avoiding temptation. Yeah, maybe you want to gossip. Maybe you want to look at something impure. Maybe you want to do something you know is wrong. There are martyrdoms in avoiding those temptations. There's martyrdoms in turning the other cheek. There are martyrdoms of patience, right? Exercise a little more patience. Maybe in traffic, let somebody else in, you offer it up. There are martyrdoms of endurance. There's martyrdoms of not getting angry when somebody else does something rude to you or you want to just retaliate. There are martyrdoms of pain. Maybe you've got chronic arthritis or migraines. Maybe you're suffering in ways that only you know. You know, a cold is a little martyrdom. If there's no complaint, you know, I think there's a lot of grace. I think when we complain with these sufferings, that diminishes the grace. Don't waste it. Don't waste it. Now, all sorts of ways to suffer today, and I invite you to do that, okay? We're going to pray the chaplet. As I said, you know, your martyrdom can be a chore, it can be arthritis, it can be emotional, it can be traffic, it can be withstanding persecutions within the family, it can be speaking truth, it can be spiritual warfare, it can be that financial struggle, it can be insult, it can be misunderstanding, it can be jealousy, it can be the loss of a loved one, it can be loneliness, it can be unfairness. There's lots of martyrdoms that we face, right? Lots of them. I just want to encourage you today to embrace that particular cross. Meditate on what yours is and then offer them up. Our Lady in Fatima told the seers there that so many souls were being lost. They were going to hell because there was no one to make sacrifice for them. You know, Matthew 16:24 says, take up your cross every day and follow me. Don't sell yourself short, all right? You have opportunities every day to win grace, to be blessed, to grow in sanctity, to really not only change your life, but to change the world. Little sacrifices can be little martyrdoms.